Okay, enough theme music. I'm about a minute late, and I already have my guest, Dr. Malinow. Malinow, hi, are you there?
I am.
Hi, how do I pronounce your last name correctly?
Malinow.
Malinow,
You had it right.
Excellent. Okay, well, welcome to Redwood Community Radio. And before we dive into I'm spacing all the names. I've been in such a stew of contracting care entities or direct care entities and all this stuff. But before we dive into this tonight, could you give a very brief history of who you are and how you came to be maybe even just a pediatrician and involved with the Physicians for a National Health Program? And also tell us a tiny bit about the Physicians for a National Health Program.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for inviting me on your show. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here. So yes, my name is Anna Malinow. I have been a general pediatrician for 28 years. I started practicing pediatrics in Cleveland, Ohio, in a very underserved area of the city. And then I moved and I practiced in Houston, Texas, in a public county hospital for 12 years, where almost all of my patients were undocumented Latinx children or refugees. And then I moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the majority of my patients were Black and poor. And then 3 years ago, I moved to the Bay Area, where I am practicing right now. So lots of experiences, lots of moving around. And I really do feel like I've had the opportunity to practice in just about every aspect of general pediatrics. I became very involved with Physicians for a National Health Program about 20 years ago and served as its national president in 2007 and 2008. I was very attracted to the organization because of their deep commitment to single-payer universal health care and to research. And much of what we now recognize as commonplace wrongs in our healthcare system were originally researched and published by PNHP members. So, for example, the lack of health insurance that causes 36,000 unnecessary deaths every year comes from PNHP, also known as Physicians for a National Health Program. Medical bills being the leading cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. also comes from Physicians for a National Health Program. How 25% of our national health expenditures goes to administration, which is much more than any other industrialized country, also comes from Physicians for a National Health Program. So we have a very long legacy, and much, much more, actually. We have a long legacy of research that I believe has informed the debate on national single payer, which we are now winning, right? Almost 70% of Americans support expanding Medicare to all. And that brings me to the other organization I'm very involved with, and that is a newer organization called National Single Payer. And we organize through national strategy of webinars, direct action, and people's healthcare curriculum to mobilize and vote for national single payer as the solution to our healthcare crisis. So that pretty much sums me up, and I think PNHP.
Excellent. Thank you so much, and thank you for all the work you've been doing. I guess so, as a group and an individual so interested in maintaining your, making a national health program, and a lot of us think of that as, the logical thing to do is just make the Medicare enrollment age be zero. And
Exactly.
so that simplest solution, be sitting there just waiting to be taken advantage of, all ripe and waiting for us. It seems to be under assault such that if we were to establish a Medicare for all system, it would not be nearly what we would hope it to be. And that would make it a lot harder to, get the sort of system you want. Could you kind of talk about, ever since Obamacare and with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation and what they are and what they're doing with their $1 billion a year of funding?
Well, those are all very good questions. And can I start with just a very brief history of Medicare? Because
Absolutely.
before we talk about direct contracting entities, before we talked about the CMMI and direct contracting entities, we have to talk about Medicare Advantage. And before we talk about Medicare Advantage, we have to talk about Medicare. So just very, very briefly,
Or not.
thumbnail view of Medicare, which we most of us know was passed during the Civil Rights era in 1965 as a public health insurance program for all people 65 years and older. And when you think about it, it's really the only healthcare system in the U.S. that is seen as a human right. That's just for people over 65. And as long as you have paid into Social Security for 10 years, then it's your right to healthcare. And over the years, Medicare has expanded the coverage to people, not only seniors, but also people with end-stage renal disease, so who are on dialysis, people with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and certain youth with disabilities. But despite its popularity, and it is very, very popular, right, get your hands off, you get your government hands off my Medicare, it still does require beneficiaries to pay premiums and deductibles. It has many gaps, such as the 20% gap for covered services under Medicare Part B. There are no out-of-pocket caps. There's no prescription drug coverage, no hearing, dental, or vision, and there is no long-term care. So even from its outset, Medicare always had a private part, also known as Medigap, or supplemental insurance, which, although not all seniors have to purchase from private health insurance to cover that 20% that Medicare does not cover. So it's a great program, but it does definitely need to be improved because it does have a lot of gaps and is very, very expensive for many seniors.
And so if you were a senior who was, I take it you can only enroll for the one time to choose an Advantage program or not, and if you don't, you're not on it for the rest of your life, or could you enroll at a later date?
No, it's actually not that way. So let's talk a little bit about Medicare Advantage. So Medicare initially was a little bit private, right? But mostly it was a public program. But commercial insurance plans were introduced into Medicare in the 80s to do two things, ostensibly, to give seniors a choice in health insurance plans, right? Mm-hmm. Whether they, that's sort of questionable, but at any rate, to give them a choice, and then to achieve the efficiencies and savings of managed care in the private sector. Something else is sort of questionable. And now almost three decades of evidence have shown us the dangers of relying on commercial insurers to protect the elderly and disabled and to reduce costs. So these commercial plans have shown us that there are significant denials of care. There are cost-related problems with the people that enroll in these commercial plans. They end up having greater cost to the federal government. Limits on specialized care due to these narrow networks, especially at the end of life. There are worse health outcomes and higher mortality for people on commercial plans. And the commercial plans end up disenrolling high-cost beneficiaries in poor health because it doesn't serve their bottom line. Now, we know these commercial insurers today in Medicare as Medicare Advantage. Now, all the evidence points against using Medicare Advantage to improve outcomes and save money, but evidence is no match for profit. And I think that that's something that we really need to keep in mind about our healthcare system, that it is profit-based. Now, when to think about Medicare, really the easiest way for me to visualize it is like a pie, where about 40% of seniors and people on Medicare have chosen a Medicare Advantage or a commercial plan to manage their Medicare. So that's 40% of the pie. That leaves 60% of individuals that have not chosen to have someone meddle and manage their Medicare, and they are known as people that still have traditional Medicare or fee-for-service. Now, of course, Medicare Advantage makes a ton of money off of these Medicare Advantage enrollees, but it's only 40% of the pie, right?
Well, and so, you said something a minute ago about disenrolling, difficult or expensive clients. How right. do they manage that? They just say, no, we don't want you anymore, and they're done?
Well, so it's not so easy because that wouldn't necessarily be the ethics. Well, who cares about ethics? It wouldn't be legal.
They're all bought at the top, but you'd think they're not quite that bought.
So what happens is, for example, they have such restricted networks that not every hospital that you need, not every specialist that you need is in their network. And so if suddenly you are diagnosed with a certain type of blood cancer or other type of cancer, other kind of autoimmune disease, and there is no doctor in your area that is on your plan, and this happens a lot in the rural areas, a lot.
Well, I've heard of private equity buying up doctors' groups in addition to that, and they might not be, and then, they have a lock on that service geographically, and they don't join any networks.
Right, exactly. So what kind of a choice does that leave the person on Medicare, right, on a Medicare Advantage plan? they have to drop out. Or the other thing that they do is they just keep denying care, mm-hmm. or asking for more and more prior authorizations. And so if you're denying care and you're delaying care, then those people are going to say, okay, well, I really can't be in this program any longer. And so I need to I need to go back to traditional Medicare. And it's very, very tricky going back to traditional Medicare, because when you first enroll into Medicare and you decide to do traditional Medicare, you can purchase these supplemental plans, also known as Medigap. And it's known as guaranteed issue, meaning that they do not look at pre-existing conditions to give you what you need to pay as your premium, because you end up paying premiums. But if you're switching out of a Medicare Advantage plan into traditional Medicare, unless you're in four states, I believe that four states have laws that protect seniors switching out of Medicare Advantage into traditional Medicare, but if you're not in those four states, then oftentimes you cannot find a supplemental plan, or you have to pay outrageous, outrageous amounts of money if you have a pre-existing condition, which most of the people from Medicare Advantage do end up having a pre-existing condition, because that's the reason that they're leaving Medicare Advantage.
Well, at some point, I think age is a pre-existing condition just on its own.
Right, right. Well, but for the supplemental plan
of the extra,
you know, you would think that it wouldn't, but that definitely is a pre-existing condition.
And California is not one of those four states?
No, it's not. It is not. It is not one of those states. I think I think Massachusetts, Connecticut. Okay, I'm talking off the top.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter. California.
All I know is California is not. So the idea is that these for-profit entities are looking at this pie, right? And they say, okay, well, 40% we already have, but what if we came up with this scheme to sucker 60% of seniors that have not chosen Medicare Advantage to be assigned, often without their knowledge or consent, to a Medicare Advantage-like program, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that would be profit. Now, despite all the evidence against Medicare Advantage, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, so CMS, in the waning days of the Trump administration, started a program called the GEO model that would take all the seniors on traditional Medicare, like the 60% of seniors, in 10 large metropolitan areas and assign them automatically, without their knowledge, without their consent, without their ability to opt out, into a Medicare-like for-profit middleman plan known as direct contracting entities, or DCEs for short. So that was the waning days of the Trump administration. It was called the GEO Project. And so the Biden administration did put, you know, to their credit, they put the GEO model on hold. But instead of putting a stop to the model altogether of these DCEs, they tweaked some of the more egregious aspects of the model and then green-lighted the full and final privatization of traditional Medicare using for-profit DCEs. So that's really where we are right now, because DCEs are not all insurance companies, and we can talk about sort of what is the makeup of these DCEs. They're not all insurance companies, but they all act like private insurance plans, replacing healthcare provider control with Wall Street control for millions of people on Medicare. They will manage the care of the beneficiaries for traditional Medicare, just like Medicare Advantage does. And just like Medicare Advantage, they can deny care, they can require prior authorizations, they can delay care. They will really be operating with pretty limited oversight, and they will use these inflated risk codes. I don't know if people are familiar about these adjusted risk scores.
I was going to ask you a bunch of questions about that in a moment.
Yeah, okay. Well, we can get into that in a minute. But basically, they use these codes to increase their own revenues. They drain the Medicare coffers, right? They don't add any value. And also, these DCEs will be able to spend as little as 60% of their revenue on patient care.
Whoa.
So think about it. Even Medicare Advantage has to use 80% of their revenues on patient care. And then compared to Medicare, traditional Medicare, that uses 97% of their revenues on patient care, these entities will only have to use as little as 60%, and the rest is going to be profit for them.
And so in reading through a bunch of this stuff, it talked about how the direct contracting entities will actually kind of be like an HMO, but they will then contract out to a bunch of hospitals or say a joint care thing and to cover all the needs for their people in a geographical area. If they're making, you know, 35% or so after overhead, are they going to be able to buy up those facilities? And could the direct contracting entity actually own the other entities that it's contracting with?
Well, they already do.
Oh.
They already do. Yes. Yes, they already do that. Because let's take a look more closely at what these direct contracting entities are, right? They're all for-profit organizations. And there are, as the program started in January of 2021, so it hasn't been around for very long, and as of April 1 of this year, there were 53 DCEs operating in 43 states plus DC. Now, it has been very difficult to identify the owners of every DCE because it's so convoluted. But it appears that of the 53 DCEs, 28 are straight-up investor-controlled, and of the 28, 6 are insurer-based. And so the others, the 25, appear to be provider-based and controlled, like, you know, physician practices, but even those physician practices are still investor-owned. I think that, you know, basically almost 100% of these DCEs are controlled by Wall Street investors. There seems to be one physician practice that is not controlled by Wall Street investors. But just think about it. Can you imagine competing against a DCE that is either an insurance company or that is an investor-controlled company? I mean, what are your chances?
And
zero.
You were mentioning that it's not just insurance companies. So insurance companies are heavily regulated, whereas these other groups aren't. And I want to read a tiny bit from Naked Capitalism, a website I'm fond of and I often encourage people to check out. This is actually how I found out about this issue. It has an unusually, like most comment sections are just, you know, ignore them all or read at your peril. But Naked Capitalism really cultivates a thoughtful, informative commentariat. And somebody had somehow through Physicians for National Health Program had become aware of this, and in their comments they just highlighted it, and that's how I got onto the issue. And a couple days later, the website themselves had noticed that comment and did a whole article on it. I believe it was on Wednesday or maybe Tuesday at nakedcapitalism.com, and they have a chunk of information that Andreessen Horowitz, who are a venture capital firm, did a sort of report on it. And they say, down one of the last things they say, blah, 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 including new entrants that previously would have been ineligible, thus creating more unique, skip a tiny bit, thus creating unique opportunities for new entrants that offer care solutions that can ultimately drive higher value care, but would not have been within the scope or incentivized with traditional Medicare fee for service.
Right.
So they're just licking their lips.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, when you think about the six insured DCEs, they're heavily involved in Medicare Advantage, right? Mm-hmm. And so not only do they have Medicare Advantage, but they also have these DCEs that basically have been created out of whole cloth in the past few months. And so they operate in, when you think about where these DCEs are, that are owned by insurance companies, they operate in 19 states with 57% of an entire national fee-for-service population. So these you know, insured DCEs know exactly where to target, right? They're not going to the places that have Medicare Advantage. They're going to the places that have traditional Medicare because they know that that's where the profit is for them right now.
Well, if you had a client on Medicare Advantage in your organization and you were able to switch them to the DCE that you own already, wouldn't you be making 20% more overhead?
How that would happen, right?
Yeah, capitation. Let's just dive into that with that, and then we'll get into the risk scoring from that, because I think people, the fee-for-service model versus a capitation coming from capital, same Latin or Greek root for cap or head or cow, I think it came from.
Right. So what fee-for-service does is it allows, and this is all for Medicare, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it allows the beneficiary, meaning the senior or the person on Medicare, to go directly to the physician of their choice without a middleman, right? and they will go to the physician, they will go to their subspecialist, they can go to whatever hospital they want, because Medicare, you know, covers, you know, almost all physicians accept Medicare, almost all subspecialists, almost all hospitals accept Medicare, right? So they have that freedom. Under a capitated system, the entity that will receive money from Medicare to take care of a certain number of lives, what they call, right? A certain number of patients. And they get, you know, a chunk of money to pay for the healthcare needs of that population. And so the idea is that they get, you know, say $1 million for a million lives. Okay, it would never be that way. It'll be $1 million for 1,000 lives, say, okay?
A year.
And so they get that, they're, this is even before risk scoring, okay? They get the $1 million, they have the 1,000 lives, and then they get to decide, because they get to decide where they go to the doctor, because they have restricted networks. So they decide which doctor they see, because they've already made these contracts with doctors that they will pay less for, right? So the system then tells the patient, well, you can only go to these doctors as your PCP, you can only go to these subspecialists, you can only go into these hospitals, you can only get this medication. If you want to go outside or do anything else, you need a prior authorization. And so the incentive for that company that is getting, you know, that capitated system, the incentive, of course, is to try to decrease the amount of care that each individual is getting, right?
Because so, they get to keep everything left over after the expenses for the year?
Because they get to keep everything left over. So,
and what
so
happens
the idea
if they
is
spend...
that you have the less care that you give, the more your profit. And the less money you spend on each individual is the more you keep in your pocket.
And what happens if somebody, you know, falls off a roof 3 times in the year and has huge bills? You lose money?
You do, and that would be one reason to tell that person to find another program. Or, for example, they would tell, you know, say, for example, that person needed physical therapy for a year. Well, they would tell the person, well, you can only have, you know, 10 visits a year or 5 visits a year, and you can only go to this physical therapist that is 100 miles away from your house.
Oh. So I'm going to put on a defending the system kind of hat for a second and say that a traditional, you know, logic by saying that fee for service isn't a good idea is because, you know, all these hypochondriac old people will go to their doctors and demand this test and demand that test. And the doctors might have a financial stake in a testing company or something. And they will all conspire to do too much healthcare and bankrupt the system. I know there are some statistics where some states or municipalities have much, much higher uses of certain, you know, by certain metrics than other ones. How big of a problem is that, or is that basically a red herring?
Well, you would think that it would be a big problem, and it is a problem, but it is not the major problem. It is not the reason why the United States has such high national health expenditures. I will tell you that that CMS and that all these health policy analysts that tell you about all the horrors of fee-for-service have a vision that the reason that the United States has such inordinately large healthcare expenditures is for two reasons. One is physician greed, and two, Americans getting too much healthcare. So according to them, to decrease costs, we either squeeze the doctors, right, by making them accept risk, you know, getting them into these capitated systems, or you squeeze the patients by decreasing deductibles, premiums, coinsurance, and copays. So if you know, squeeze the doctors by telling them, okay, you are in these capitated systems, and so you cannot deliver care because the minute that you do, then you're not going to be making a profit. Or you squeeze the patients by telling them, you know, you've got to stop going to the doctor so much, when compared to other countries, Americans do not go to the doctor so much. And most people don't want to go to the doctor. Most people don't want to get these expensive colonoscopies and endoscopies and so forth.
And that might cost more in the long run.
And I'm sorry?
That might cost more in the long run. By people not doing that. Whereas if you had, you know, every year like clockwork, you have your, you know, free to the user tests for anything. I mean, I definitely don't want to encourage people to get too much tests, but it seems like avoiding the doctor is not a good idea either.
Right, right. And so because people don't know when to avoid the doctor, if they're worried about too much cost, they will avoid the doctor when it's necessary and when it's not necessary. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have a really, really bad headache, you know, okay, so you take an aspirin, but it could also be a stroke or it could be meningitis or, right? And that's why you go to the doctor for the doctor to tell you, okay, well, it's just a migraine or it's a tension headache and, or not. But at any rate, it's this idea that the reason why the U.S. healthcare system is so expensive is because, you know, doctors are greedy or Americans are getting too much. They go to the doctor too much. And when you look at the real causes of healthcare costs in the United States, it is not because Americans are getting too much healthcare. But can I just go back 1 minute before we get off the subject of direct contracting entities? Because I really think that as a doctor, I think that the most nefarious aspect of this model is how seniors will be assigned to these DCEs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, again, remember the pie. 40% have chosen, boom, I want Medicare Advantage to manage my care. And then 60% have chosen not to do that. So when you have these seniors that have specifically chosen not to enroll in a private insurance plan under Medicare, how do you get these people on a non-traditional Medicare Advantage-like plan? Well, you don't really tell them. You lure their primary care doctors to participate in the DCE by promising these doctors much better Medicare reimbursement rates. And once the doctors sign up under a DCE, so they themselves are not making a DCE, they're just signing up under a DCE, all their patients are automatically aligned by CMS with the DCE the doctor has chosen.
But what if a senior had been seeing different doctors for different things, and or are you assigned a on-paper primary health care physician? I mean,
well, this is a really great question because there are two ways that people are going to be aligned, as they call them.
Uh-huh.
They're not being assigned; they're being aligned to a DCE. The most common way is going to be through your PCP. So, if you have a PCP and that PCP suddenly, you know, has decided that they're going to be part of this DCE, then you are automatically going to be aligned to that DCE. If, however, you have multiple doctors, then it's going to be through a process known as claim processing. And so CMS will look at all of your claims and see which place you go to most frequently,
uh-huh,
and then align you to a DCE of where you go most frequently to. So what happens is that you end up sending this patient a letter in the mail that they're likely not going to read or understand, and presto, you suddenly have 30 million seniors previously on traditional Medicare under a DCE, and that's how you finally and fully privatize Medicare, and it leverages the doctor-patient relationship and basically monetizes it for the profit of corporations.
Hmm. Could I digress a tiny bit? And since you are a pediatrician and people are aware of CHIP, the Children's Health Care Insurance Program,
mm-hmm,
how does that work? How is the funding for that?
Well, it's really interesting. I have to be honest with you. As a pediatrician, I do not see patients on Medicare. It's rare.
Because you're at UCSF, so you're more of a you teach and stuff? Or
No. Pediatricians just don't see patients over 65.
Oh yeah, duh, of course, yeah.
Yeah. So I'll be perfectly honest with you. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years. I'm a pediatrician for 28 years, but also in health activism and organizing and mobilizing and for 20 years. And I had never heard about direct contracting entities until 3 months ago. And it sort of came across my, sort of like with you with naked capitalism, it sort of came across my email, and I started looking into it. And just like with so much in U.S. healthcare, I looked, and the more I read, the more appalled that I became. So, you know, it doesn't really affect pediatricians. It probably doesn't affect obstetricians, but it really affects internal medicine doctors, and I'm sure emergency medicine doctors and so forth that are dealing with Medicare patients. But to answer the question about the Children's Health Insurance Program, that is a system under Medicaid, which is state and federally funded, but administered by the states. And so the states have criteria that you need to fulfill in order to be able to qualify for the Children's Health Insurance Program. And the criteria are age-based, under CHIP, age-based, and income-based.
But how do they pay the bills? Is it capitation or fee-for-service?
For CHIP? So this is really interesting. CHIP is sort of a tiny, tiny program. It's a tiny program. I don't think anybody's really all that interested in it. Medicaid is much, much, much bigger. And that is almost fully privatized through these entities called MCOs, which are Medicare Managed Care Organizations, Medicaid Managed Care Organizations. And that's sort of another story that has gone under the radar as well. CHIP is a pretty small program. I believe that CHIP is also privatized, and they probably do have managed CHIP organizations. But that's not really where the money is. Children is not where the money is. Okay, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, somebody said that they thought Medicare came about because the insurance industry was able to collect premiums for people all the time they're healthy when they're young, and then dump them off on the federal government when the large
old
bills
absolutely
came.
Absolutely, 100%. 100%.
It is past 7:30, and we have people who have already started calling in, and since I am both engineering this talk show and... Let's just be very clear. Redwood Community Radio is not endorsing anything I say just because I happen to be working the board at the same time that I am doing this. Just to let you know, I used to just be an engineer, and then eventually one of my talk show hosts left and I just took the slot. But we do have a caller who called in, and if you do want to call in 923-3911, I'm not going to be able to process you and talk to you. You'll just hear some clicks, and eventually you'll hear some more clicks, and we'll say you're on the air. And we do have that one person waiting. I'll get right to you, and then we will dive into risk scores. And if a lot of people don't end up calling in, we'll talk about some of the history of the Office for Medicare Innovation and some of the personnel there and their history. Yeah. So in the meantime...
And also, I want to talk about what people can do, right?
Let's
leave some time for that.
We leave time for that, definitely. And also, people who do call in, do not listen on your radio because there's a long delay and you will miss the switch over. But our first caller, you are on the air.
Well, thank you very much. So this was an interesting wake-up to me. I have a comment and then two questions. The comment is, the last time I checked, and this was a couple of years ago, pre-COVID, my insurance agent said that Medicare Advantage was not available in this county because there weren't enough providers. And I was lured into inquiring because of the fact that it offered dental and optical coverage as well. But she informed me that it wasn't available because of the fact that there weren't enough in-network providers. So I don't know whether your guest factors that into her statements about Medicare Advantage. But so the questions are, first of all, I'm going to take kind of Michael's position and be kind of a apologist for the state in this matter and say that we are looking in this country and a lot of other developed countries and with a inverted population pyramid, or not quite inverted, but the question is how the burden of our healthcare, the seniors amongst us, is going to be carried by a smaller working force. And so I'd like her to address that, but let me ask my second question also, and it sounds like she's going to get to that, and that is, I really like traditional Medicare. It's served me really well, and I don't want to lose it, and I want to know whether there's any way to stand against what seems to be a juggernaut, the way she's describing it. So that said, I will listen, turn my radio back on, and listen on the air. Did you get those, Michael?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, thank you.
Okay, good. Can I answer?
Yeah, please.
Okay, great, great. So two fantastic questions. One is about the burden that's going to be carried by a smaller working force because we do have the baby boomers. And this is the reason why, well, let's get to it. What is the solution, right? The solution is Medicare for All. It's a national single-payer program that is financed through taxes, not through premiums, not through copays, not through deductibles, not through coinsurance. And that is the way that we should be financing our healthcare system, just like every other country does. And we will actually, if we do that, we will be able to have a much more comprehensive healthcare system than we have right now. And it will include dental and vision and hearing and long-term care and prescription drugs and mental health and substance abuse, all of those things that right now are being carved out. So the answer to your question is, yes, let's not put the burden on the smaller working force, but let's put the tax burden on everyone. The people that can pay more should be paying more, and the people that can't pay more should be paying less, and should be a progressive tax. And that's how it's done in other industrialized countries, and that's how they are able to have universal health coverage for all of their residents.
And even the Koch brothers in their research found that a Medicare for All system would cover everybody for less expense than we're expending now
if you included all the
employer donations and everything.
Yes.
So it would save money. It's the only way we're going to help the younger generations out.
Right. We help everybody out. We help the seniors because we give them a much, much better program than they have right now. And then we also help out young people that are overly represented in the uninsured. So everyone needs health care, not just those over 65. Right. Mm-hmm. So and then the second question about traditional Medicare and how much you like it. Most people that are on traditional Medicare do like it a lot. And I think that everybody should be, you know, really mad about what's happening and how they're going to be aligned through CMS into these for-profit middlemen without their knowledge or their consent. I mean, yes, they're going to be sending you a letter in the mail that you might or might not read, and you might or might not understand. And you have the option to opt out, but it's going to be sort of interesting, and I don't think that people have the answer to this. So if you opt out of the DCE, will your physician tell you, okay, you can still stay in my practice, I will still be your PCP, but you do not need to sign up on this DCE? I don't know what the answer to that is. I honestly don't know. And so it's... It's something that flies in the face of continuity of care, which we know is one of the central tenets of good health care.
I have a potential solution, or at least an idea, which really would only apply in our immediate sort of southern Humboldt area, is that I'm going to assume that a lot of our local people, their primary health care physician is either at Redwoods Rural or at the Southern Humboldt Healthcare District, one a member-controlled organization and the other a public hospital organization, healthcare district. Could people go to the boards of those organizations and through, you know, elections or just through good lobbying, get them to have a policy that they will not join any DCEs and maintain, even though they would potentially lose out on a source of more revenue potentially? Is that possible, you think?
I think that when people organize, I think it's always a good idea. As an organizer, I think it's always a great idea. But I think that you have to think about the financial pressures that these medical organizations are facing. And if they decide that they're not going to do it, there's going to be somebody else who will come in They will have, you know, all this venture capital behind them.
Well, but that's why I said it was for really only for Southern Humboldt, because there really are only those two healthcare facilities down here.
Mm-hmm.
So in a very rural area, maybe.
You could have another, it's very, very easy to set up another physician practice and just lure physicians in from other parts of the country, tell them, you know, that they're going to be getting these fantastic salaries, just come and practice here, and they'll open up shop right across the street.
I just don't think that's going to, just because we're such a rural area, and I
that's
know
probably through, not going to happen. You're right.
It's really hard to recruit any physicians here, unfortunately.
I think that the more likely, I think it's great that you do have two community controlled organizations. It's pretty incredible.
Yep.
The more likely outcome is that one or two will be shuttered because maybe they're not making enough money to make ends meet. And that's what's being repeated across the country.
Well, and that is
in rural areas.
That's an excellent segue, because one of our organizations maybe 10 years ago was on the brink of insolvency, and a new manager came in and hired experts, or brought with them expertise in medical coding, and they went through all their stuff, and they basically, what I would say, you know, if I was being uncharitable, I would say they fraudulently upcoded everything they can, having found a good specialist, or charitably saying they had left a lot of potential money on the table that they could bill for. So what is upcoding? And, you know, we talk about the physician coding for risk scores, kind of one and the same thing.
Right.
And how that applies to capitation.
So, you know, again, as a pediatrician, I have not really experienced this firsthand, but I have been reading about it and hearing about it from my colleagues in internal medicine who do see Medicare patients. And so the idea is, whenever you go to the doctor, people know that they get sort of an after-visit summary. And in the after-visit summary, there are a list of diagnoses, right? The diagnosis is either a well visit, high blood pressure, overweight, diabetes, you know, whatever, you know, the whatever diagnosis you have, or healthy, or, you know, whatever they have, you go home with a certain number of diagnoses. So I think people are familiar with that. Now, what these Medicare Advantage companies do in order to get more money from Medicare is that Medicare, for a healthy 70-year-old, will pay about $6,000 per year, somebody that has no diagnoses whatsoever. But say that 70-year-old does happen to have high blood pressure, diabetes, and overweight, okay? For those three diagnoses, the health plan does get paid more money, and they should, right? They should, because this patient is probably going to be a little bit more complicated because of the high blood pressure, and you've got to think about that and the diabetes and so forth. And so for just those simple diagnoses, then the health plan will get reimbursed from Medicare $9,000. But there's a whole industry that Medicare Advantage has created to upcode these simple codes to get more reimbursement from Medicare. And so, for example, instead of diabetes, they will put in retinopathy or neuropathy, and that increases the risk score that would normally have been like 1 to 3, for example. I'm just throwing out numbers.
No, you're not.
Instead of being overweight, the person now becomes morbidly obese, and then that risk score goes from being 0.4 to 2.5. The high blood pressure, instead of being, you know, a risk for a risk score of 1, becomes uncontrolled hypertension, and then it has a risk score of 2.7.
When you
add up all of these risk scores, what happens is that you increase the amount of reimbursement from Medicare, and it can be up to, like, the same person that used to cost Medicare $9,000 is suddenly, with the exact same problems, now costing $35,000. And so there's a whole industry behind this to get Medicare Advantage companies to get more profit and to get more reimbursement from Medicare. And that's what the risk score gaming is all about.
I'm actually looking at a table of the risk scores. Maybe it's similar to the information you had.
Yeah, what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, like, you know, you can say major depression, it would be zero, or major depression, single episode, mild, it goes to 0.395. So it's a significant. Mm-hmm. You just call it, you talked about diabetes. You were close, but it was even worse than you were thinking. Type 2 diabetes is a 0.104 factor. And then diabetes mellitus with retinopathy. Wait, it must be, I think they mean retinopathy. Oh, no, retinopathy is because your eyes are dying. Yeah,
retinopathy.
Yeah, yeah, that's mm-hmm. So it's a 0.318. So it's more than triple the the money. And so 40% of 32,000 is a lot more than 40% of 9,000. And if you had, in the information I have, a healthy 76-year-old female with no extra codes whatsoever only earns them $4,000.
Yeah. Okay. So I had the numbers a little bit off,
but you were ballpark. Sort of absolutely. Yeah.
The idea here, which is what you're trying to do, is to find more and more and more diagnoses for the exact same patient with the exact same medical condition. And the more of these diagnoses that you have, it's called, or the sort of the more dramatic you make it, it's called upcoding, because that will give you greater reimbursement rates. Mm-hmm. And that's fraud. It's fraud, but nobody is making these Medicare Advantage plans do much. And we know that Medicare Advantage has upcoded and resulted in billions and billions and billions of dollars.
And if you're able to upcode and keep 40%, there's a lot of room for, you know, call it kickbacks or maybe call mm-hmm. it something else to the doctors or the hospitals or whatever, to both encourage them to upcode. And once they have you in a more lucrative, you know, code, then to, you know, give as little care as possible.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So, mm-hmm. I made a comment to somebody where, you know, they thought this would lead to people getting way too many tests. And I was like, no, they'll just test you enough at the beginning to say you're sick. And then they will, you know, give you studied indifference and, you know, optimism will be the treatments they'll give you.
That's right. And the truth is that sometimes with some of these diagnoses, you get extra money for the rest of that person's life.
Uh-huh. And so even if you weren't doing it for the rest of their life, there's really no incentive to get people cured of whatever their issue was.
Well, if there's more money, then yes. But if it's going to cost you money, then not necessarily.
Yeah. There was a quote, I'm not finding any of this thing I'm looking at, where they were, both parties, meaning the contracting entities and the hospitals or doctors group, share in accountability and responsibilities across care, continuation, and outcomes. And so it seemed to me that having two different groups being responsible for essentially issuing denials, it gives you just, you know, before you only have one insurance company to deal with a denial, whereas now there would be two people who would be able to deny you.
You mean the physician and the DCE?
Yeah, that seemed to be one of the things that the Anderson Horowitz was saying was a good thing about it, is because there'll be two people now who are able to essentially contain the costs.
Right. Well, no, you do. You do have an incentive among those physicians then, because they know that they're going to be getting better reimbursement from the DCE. Yes. Yeah. Right. So not for the right reasons.
No. I do want to leave a little bit. I mean, how much time do you want for solutions and to give information at the end? Because I'd like to ask a couple questions about even the California single payer attempts. And...
Yeah. No, definitely. Let's talk about that, because I do think that is important to talk about.
So I had guest Norman Solomon on last month, and we were talking about the recall election. And I kind of was snidely saying, well, the legislature was able to get a California single-payer initiative to the governor's desk when it was Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was never going to sign it. Yet they've been unable to get it on the desk of a governor who, at least, you know, rhetorically would sign it. Do you know? Is there something going on there? what's the scoop?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, I think, you know, people can connect the dots. But I, as far as whether I think that the solution is a state-based single-payer plan, my view is that it isn't.
Oh, and why is that? Because I actually kind of agree.
That it isn't the plan, that it isn't the solution.
I mean, because I'm into modern monetary theory, and I don't envision it being paid out of taxes per se, but it's just a bill that the federal government pays. And that sort of system needs to be created and paid for by a currency issuer, the sovereign state, not a subsidiary state who does not issue their own currency. So I like the idea, and I'm supportive of people who want to go for that, because it will push the boundaries. And the example of Canada with Alberta or Saskatchewan, I forget which one, being the first state to do the Canadian National Healthcare, what became the Canadian National Healthcare Program on a statewide basis first, then led to the larger program. But what are your concerns?
Right, right. I don't think that we can use Saskatchewan or Canada really as a model. The United States is very, very different from Canada, and California is definitely different from Saskatchewan. But I will tell you why I think that there are many reasons why state single-payer plan won't work. For one, the finances just don't add up. I'm not very familiar with the modern monetary theory, but what you would need to do is to funnel federal Medicare dollars to the state, which is one great way to slice and dice and ultimately destroy the federal public program known, you know, as Medicare. And Representative Ro Khanna recently introduced the State-Based Universal Healthcare Act of 2021, and that bill would offer pass-through federal fund waivers to states that with a plan to provide comprehensive health benefits to 95% of its residents within 5 years. But as far as I'm concerned, it would end Medicare as we know it. Leaving healthcare to states is not the solution, as we've seen with Medicaid expansion, which has left out most southern states with high percentages of people of color. So if you ask me, should we fight for a program that instead of expanding and improving Medicare eliminates it so that we can have a 50-tier system of health care, one for each state, I would say no, I don't agree with that.
Okay, and we have one caller. You're almost at the top of the hour here, caller. So caller, you're on the air. Please be very brief.
Yeah, I'll keep it tight since we're up against the clock, Michael. Jeff Wright on the Mendocino Coast. And just basically a yes or no on this. I have VA. They're trying to privatize it. I'm wondering if a similar aspect is going on that's going on with the Medicare aspect, Medicare Advantage, and these county programs where they're taking mental health and substance abuse and privatizing the subcontractors in the name of the county. Are those going through similar direct contracting? I'll leave it at that. And yes or no at this point, that's fine, and maybe that's subject for future programming. Thank you, as always, Michael. Great show.
Excellent question. Thank you very much.
I agree. Excellent question. So for the VA, absolutely, 100%. I don't think they're doing the DCEs through the VA, but they're definitely trying to privatize it, and they're going to be cutting and slicing it and destroying the VA as we know it. And then I'm not familiar with the county programs that the caller was referring to. I don't know if that's going through DCEs. DCEs are, as I said, relatively new. They've just started their demonstration program in January, and as of April, there are 53 of them. But so I'm not familiar if that's sort of what's causing the privatization of those county programs.
What little I know a tiny bit about that issue, and I think it does predate the DCEs, but in some ways it almost is one because they've kind of privatized it. And there's one more caller. I'm going to take this caller incredibly quickly. Caller, you got like 20 seconds, then we got to get to solutions.
That's it. Okay, I want to do a little local activism. The numbers for the community health care district and the executive director there, Matt Reese, are 923-3921. And the numbers for the health center are 923-2783, and the executive director is Tina Tvet. And you might ask them whether they're being lured into BCEs. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Excellent.
That's a good idea. So do I have a minute to talk about
what
people
like
can do?
Yeah, you got like 3 minutes. Four minutes even.
All right.
Three minutes.
So the first thing that I tell people that they need to do is to become informed. Right. PNHP and National Single Payer recently hosted a webinar on DCEs, which you can access by going on YouTube and then just typing in direct contracting entities PNHP, and then you will be able to listen to an hour and 30 minutes of people explaining the DCEs, I think, very, very well. And one of our panelists included Representative Katie Porter from California. And she talked about the letter that she and three of her colleagues sent to Secretary Becerra, demanding the immediate halt to these DCEs, and then they never got a reply. So I would say that the webinar is an excellent place to start to become informed about this under-the-radar effort to privatize and end Medicare as we know it. So that's one. And then number two, people can go to the PNHP website and sign a petition that we put together that we're going to be sending to Secretary Becerra. Right after the webinar, we got 1,000 signatures in the first 12 hours. Now we're above 3,000 signatures, and I think we really need to have thousands of people telling Secretary Becerra that we know what's up and that we won't stand for it. He must eliminate DCEs and any effort to privatize traditional Medicare. And there's also a letter template that you can download and send to your congressperson. But finally, we do really encourage people to sign up to join the National Single Payer Call to Action on October 13th, where we hope to plan direct action tactics to achieve our goal. So, you know, having the petition is one thing, writing letters is another, but we really want to have people come together and generate action items to achieve this goal to stop DCEs. And the website that people can go to is nationalsinglepayer.com, and you will see my email there, and I will send you the link to the Zoom call on October 13. I think that people need to understand that this is a winnable fight. I think it's hard to be a Medicare for All activist these days. It truly is, but this is a winnable fight for Medicare for All. If we organize and if we push, we have a chance to end this thing for good. Activists must send a message to the Biden administration. We want to keep Medicare public and nonprofit for this generation and the next.
Excellent. Well, we're just about at the top of the hour. I will throw out that number, which is very close to the KMUD phone number. It was 923-3921. I believe that was for the Southern Humboldt Healthcare District. And I guess we can just leave it at that. Dr. Anna Malinow, thank you so much for your time this evening.
Okay. Thank you so much for giving me the time to talk about this really, really important issue. But we can win. This is a fight we can win.
And what's the website again?
It's called nationalsinglepayer.com for the call to action. And if you wanted to sign the petition, it's PNHP.org. That's Physicians for National Health Program.org.
Thank you very much.
All right, that's great. Thank you, Michael.
Have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.